Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. You have me and the fabulous and one and only Kit with you today. Kit, tell us, who have we got on?
We are joined by Dr. Alice Vernon. She is a lecturer of creative writing at Aberystwyth University, and she is here to talk to us about her first book, Troubled Sleep and the Stories We Tell About It, which looks at the history, cultural impact, and the science of disturbing sleep across the ages.
Hello, thank you for having me.
I'm actually really looking forward to this because we get to talk about something that we just don't talk about every day, let alone in history.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that 70% of us will experience in our lifetime. These strange hallucinatory sleep states and lucid dreams, sleep paralysis. You know, to have 70% of us experience that, and we simply don't talk about it enough.
Well, it's a really interesting area to look at because, as you say, 70% of people experience it, but everyone experiences it so differently. So what attracted you to look into this subject of the cultural and historical impact of night terrors and interrupted sleep?
So this is something that has affected me since I was a child. I used to sleepwalk when I was little. And then as a teenager, I started to hallucinate in my sleep, very specifically in my sleep. If I started hallucinating in the daytime, that would be a completely different thing. But I was hallucinating, just as I was waking up in the middle of the night, and I would see spiders and people in my room and things like that. And then I did my PhD and they got progressively worse, which is related, perhaps. But I was doing my PhD on insomnia. Because at the time, it was sort of 2015 to 2018, at the time, if you went on The Guardian, there would be an article about insomnia. And so I was doing my PhD on how we represented insomnia throughout history and throughout culture. And as I was investigating this, I sort of was paying more attention to my own sleep and wondering for the first time kind of why my sleep was so weird and realizing that these were actual conditions. Because I was reading all these kind of very scientific books about sleep, and I was learning about REM and sleep paralysis and all these different types of things. And I was going, oh, hey, I have that. And oh, I have that. And so that really persuaded me to really investigate my own sleep more. And as I started to do so, I realized just how ingrained some of these sleep disorders are in terms of culture and history. We can trace some of these sleep disorders back to things like witchcraft trials and, Greek medicine and things like that. And it's the same sort of things that we experience today, which I find really fascinating is that, the experiences that I have and the experience that 70% of us have, you can find in old case studies and old, medical textbooks.
So that's the background. And you mentioned that you have your own night terrors. Now, Alina and I have also experienced night terrors ourselves. It might be helpful actually just to talk a little bit about it. So I have very odd dreams. I think most people dream that they are still themselves. I have never dreamt that I am Kit Chapman in any of my dreams.
Really?
Ever.
That's fascinating.
I'm always somebody else. It's very, very strange. But I've had night terrors. I have woken up and not been able to move and literally been sort of physically sort of almost trapped in myself in the bed. I had a case once where I was in Las Vegas with a young lady sharing a hotel room. And apparently she was down on the casino floor. I was asleep. Apparently when she came in, I sat bolt upright in bed, turned, looked at her, screamed at her as loudly as I could.
And went straight back to sleep.
And I have no memory of this. So night terrors are an old friend. How about you, Alina?
Do you know what? I don't really want to go into too much detail about some of my night terrors, because then people will get an idea of the inside of my working mind, or not so working mind sometimes. But mine have been things from trauma, and because I'm an only child, for people that don't know this, and a lot of people don't understand how hard sometimes it can be being an only child. You suffer with things, obviously not now as an adult, but as a child I suffered with things like abandonment and things. And that involved my great-grandmother when she died. She died when I was 6 years old. So I would have such vivid nightmares of walking out into the garden, and she would accuse me of things like that she killed her. And it was just mind-boggling things. And I would wake up, I would sleepwalk at some stages as well during these dreams. And these are very reoccurring dreams. And occasionally in my adult life, they actually come back. And I only get night terrors when I'm under severe stress. Alice, as you said, you were doing your PhD, it's severe stress. So for me, it manifests in that way too. I also, well, those who don't know, I work on very horrific and dark things, and my night terrors sometimes appear in my own research. So I have been stuck in things like concentration camps, and I wake up screaming and crying, and these are so vivid that I'm literally being able to touch things. I don't wish this on anybody, is the bottom line. But Alice, what about you? What are yours manifesting?
Mine are mostly to do with sleep paralysis and hallucinations. And I usually hallucinate my one true fear, which is spiders, on my bed. And with sleep paralysis, for me, the sort of stereotypical episode of sleep paralysis is that obviously you can't move, but your brain then hallucinates a hag or a witch or a monster sitting on your chest. For me, it's disembodied hands on my mattress. I can feel them all around my neck, and they're grabbing me and grabbing my ankles. And once I had one where I felt like I had been dragged down the mattress, and then I woke up properly and I hadn't moved, but I just had this very visceral feeling of hands grabbing my ankles and yanking me down the mattress. It's horrendous.
I can completely understand that. I can't actually sleep without something covering my feet, because I have this innate fear that something's going to be grabbing me. But we understand that this is psychology. We understand this is hallucination. Obviously, in the ancient world, that vocabulary just didn't exist necessarily. So how did ancient societies first view these conditions?
I think probably the best place to start is with a Roman philosopher called Macrobius from the 5th century. And he described sleep and sleep disorders in terms of these five specific conditions. So he said there was the prophetic vision, where you saw the future in your dream, the nightmare. So that was an old word actually for sleep paralysis. The way we use nightmare today just sort of means bad dream, but the word nightmare historically is related to sleep paralysis. Now, the nightmare, the ghostly apparition, the enigmatic dream, and we're not quite sure what it means, but we know it tells us something, and the oracular dream as well, that's kind of, you know, shows us a vision or gives us information. And it was, I think, particularly the prophetic vision and the oracular dream that in sort of Greek and Roman sort of classical antiquity, that was the most important idea of what dreams were, that they were a gift from the gods, so they had some sort of divine meaning. And there was a Greek god of medicine called Asclepius, and he had shrines, and you would go to Asclepius' shrine if you were ill or you knew somebody who was ill, and you would go there and you would sleep in the hope that Asclepius would give you a dream of how to cure yourself or how to cure your loved one. So it was a kind of a form of medical intervention almost to have a dream that, you know, you would get the information you needed to be well again, or to have your family member be well again.
I find that very interesting, that whole ideology of the ancient times, because if you look at things like the oracles, and historians looking at it from a modern perspective are saying, you know, they were inhaling drugs or other various different reasons for things happening, and how they interpret nightmares, for me, is just amazing to what we now know what night terrors truly are and how they manifest. But what about the Middle Ages? So does history look at it slightly differently because you've got the rise of the Catholic Church, or is this something completely opposite to the ancient period where they looked at it as a gift from the gods, to something where people are being demonized and called witches and all sorts of things?
Yeah, so from the Middle Ages to really sort of the Renaissance, it gets really quite messy and conflicted in terms of the different ideas of what was causing some of these strange sleep phenomena. So we still have, in obviously the sort of rise of Christianity and Catholicism, we have the idea that dreams can be given from God or from an angel if they're good and if they have some sort of, you know, holy ideology or symbolism. What is interesting in particular is that in the Middle Ages, it was believed that the sleeper was not to be blamed for their actions in sleep. So I think with the Middle Ages, we perhaps associate that with maybe, you know, demons and witches. But actually, there was a real sort of idea that if you did something bad in your sleep, you were not to be blamed for it. And there was a particular reason for this, which is that I think particularly high-ranking members of the church were worried that if they did something a little bit erotic in their sleep or had a wet dream or something in particular, that it was not sinful because they couldn't be blamed for it because it happened in their sleep. So it was a kind of a way of getting out of trying to explain what had happened to them in their sleep. You know, if they said it was a gift from the gods or if it was something, you know, given by a demon, then that would kind of implicate them morally. So to say that they weren't to be blamed for the fact that they had an erotic dream or something, you know, it kind of got them out of having to explain that. But then we also get, you know, high-ranking members of the church like Saint Albert the Great, who was a German friar in the 13th century, who believed that dreams were given by angels or demons, that they could control a person's sleep. So we have kind of different avenues of ideas that they could be given by God, or that they could be given by demons and witches, or that it was just a natural thing, so that if you did have an erotic dream, you couldn't be blamed for it and kicked out of the church.
I mean, that's absolutely fascinating that they're sort of trying to look at a way to almost excuse their behaviour or to sort of essentially mythologise and theologise something as simple as erection in the morning or something like that. And moving on to sort of other subjects, we've got the books like The Hammer of the Witches, the Malleus Maleficarum, that comes out in the Middle Ages. We have Discovery of Witchcraft. How does this affect the public perception of troubled sleep? Because we've talked about the church and how they view it, but this is sort of spreading the information out to the public. And does that manifest in the witch hunts, the witch trials that we later see?
Well, the Discovery of Witchcraft is actually really interesting because that was written by Reginald Scott in 1584. And in that, he talks about sleep paralysis or the incubus, which was another name for it. It was that kind of little goblin chap that you see in Henry Fuseli's painting of the nightmare, so this incubus. And he calls it a bodily disease. And he says it's not to do with witches. It's because you've eaten too much before you went to bed and it's laying too heavily on your stomach. And that's why you're having sleep paralysis. But he emphasizes that it is a bodily disease. And so that was 1584. And then the Salem witch trials, those famous witch trials of dozens of people were murdered for being accused of witchcraft. That was 1692. So that was actually well over 100 years after Reginald Scott had published this treatise saying sleep paralysis is because you've eaten too much. And in the Salem witch trials, you can access the court papers online. And in some of those, there's one particular in the case of Bridget Bishop, who was accused of witchcraft. And in those accusations, a man says that she came into his bedroom in the middle of the night and he couldn't move. He was frozen. He couldn't defend himself. And she grasped him by the throat and was trying to choke him. And he said that was Bridget Bishop. And if you read that court transcript, it's sleep paralysis that this man has had, essentially, which I find really fascinating, that it was very slow, I suppose, for this idea that sleep paralysis wasn't to do with witchcraft, for this idea to actually be prevalent and be the main way of thinking about sleep paralysis. You know, it took a while for disordered sleep to shake off those supernatural associations. And I think even today, you know, there is still that association with demons and the supernatural and even aliens. But, you know, at a time when people were genuinely afraid of witchcraft, it took time for those beliefs to be dispelled.
This is actually probably a good point to bring in, because you do discuss the science a little bit in your book. So do we know, eating a lot of cheese cause sleep paralysis? Is that a thing?
I think probably if you eat too much of something, you're not going to feel very well, and that's probably going to affect your sleep. But in terms of the science of sleep paralysis, it's really fascinating. So when we dream, our brain is actually sending messages to our muscles as though to act out what we think we're doing in our dream. So if we dream that we're playing tennis, our brain is sending signals to our muscles to move our arms, to hit that ball back to Roger Federer or whoever you're playing tennis with, Mary Berry, I don't know what a dream would be like for you. There are several reasons why that would be really bad. And particularly from an evolutionary point, if you're sleeping in a tree or on the side of a cliff or something, and you start thrashing around in your sleep, you're going to fall off and die. So the brain actually paralyzes the body, and then it can send all the signals it likes to our muscles, but our muscles don't move. So every time we dream, we are actually paralyzed. But for those of us who are lucky enough to have sleep paralysis, we sort of wake up before we're supposed to, while our brain is still paralyzing the body. And we're in a weird half awake, half asleep state where we're still dreaming, but we're also awake. And because we can't move and we're still sort of dreaming, our brain thinks up a fun way to explain why we can't move. And sleep paralysis, it feels very heavy on the chest. You know, it's kind of your whole body is paralyzed, but it seems to particularly be focused on the chest. And so your brain will come up with this idea that something is sitting on you. And so that's where we get this idea of the hag or the witch. You know, some old names for sleep paralysis were things like being hag ridden, or my favorite, which was being wizard pressed. Being pressed by a wizard. I quite like that one. Yeah, so there is a way that, you know, science explains sleep paralysis, but obviously this hasn't been discovered until we could start to map brain waves in the mid-20th century. So really there's an entire gulf where we've had to try and explain sleep paralysis in a rational way, but while still not really knowing anything about it or why it's happening to us. So the cheese thing is a myth, but obviously if you're not eating well before you go to bed, you're probably going to have an upset stomach, and that's going to affect your sleep. But yes, it is a natural process. We're just waking up before we're supposed to, essentially.
Well, it's quite interesting that we're looking at the Salem witch trials, which are end of the 17th century, and this is just when the Enlightenment starts to begin as well, and we start getting science actually as formalized as science rather than alchemy, things like that. So is that what helps change society's perceptions of what's going on? Is it this evolution of social science and the ability to actually have scientists, or is something else happening?
I think in some respects it was to do with, you know, the idea of natural philosophy and thinking about what happens in the stomach and all those sorts of, you know, weird digestive juices and all the vapors going to the brain, and thinking of sleep in very physical and physiological terms, and trying to explain some of these strange phenomena in terms of disordered stomachs. And it was all about disordered digestion, sort of between the, you know, really from Reginald Scott in 1584 to the Victorian era, really. You know, even Scrooge says, when he's in A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, Scrooge says to these ghosts, "Oh, you're just a crumb of cheese," you know. So even in the Victorian era, it was this idea that, you know, a bad digestion would cause this. But even so, I think there was still an association with the supernatural, and particularly in the Victorian era, and towards the end of the Victorian era, actually, in the sort of 1880s to 1890s, we get the development of the Society for Psychical Research, who are awesome, and they're still going, and they're like a kind of scientific ghost hunting club. They're great. But when they were first developed, one of the first big projects they undertook was something called the Census of Hallucinations, where they asked about 17,000 people to respond to a question, which was, you know, have you ever seen something that wasn't really there? And the responses they got back, the majority of them are easily explained as a sleep hallucination or sleep paralysis. And it's really interesting, some of these anecdotes, but what the Society for Psychical Research were really looking for was any sort of anecdote that couldn't be explained, because then they could go, ah, well, that was obviously a ghost then. So there was still this idea that, you know, some of these sleep disorders and some of these strange things that happened to people in the middle of the night could still be explained through supernatural means. So even in the Victorian era, even though we were sort of starting to realize how the brain worked and how the stomach worked properly and all those kinds of things, we still get this sense of, ooh, but what if that was a ghost? Ooh, you know, what if that was a witch? Got to, you know, really rule all these things out. So even, yeah, even in the Victorian era, the science and the supernatural was still sort of fighting for precedence, really.
I'm going to say this in front of Kit, and I hope he doesn't ban me from being his friend ever. But however much we say we've progressed in the 21st century, I'm one of these people that still in the back of my mind may think, what if it was a witch? What if it is a ghost? What if everything my eyes are telling me that it's not? My brain's like, no, that is not what it is. But secretly eating it, I'll get the look on Kit's face. I'm so sorry. The look on Kit's face, everyone, is like he's actually going to ban me from being his friend. But
I am judging you. I'm just putting that out there. I'm absolutely judging you, but please go on.
I'm going to make an idiot of myself. No, I'm not really. So my question is, does this, because we've touched on the Victorian period, but does the early 20th century change anything? I mean, some of us still believe in ghosts, like me. And Alice, you were nodding a little bit, so hopefully you still believe in ghosts. Kit doesn't believe in any ghosts. He's a scientist.
I mean, I really do, you know, empathize with you, Alina, because sometimes, even though I've done all this research and I can rationalize it to the tiniest degree, sometimes I still think, oh, that could have been a ghost, you know, I still don't know, because it does feel so real. And you think, how can my brain come up with these kinds of delusions and vivid hallucinations? So I think, even now, I can rationalize things and go, oh, that was just my brain naturally paralyzing my body and I woke up before I'm supposed to. I still think, well, it could have been a witch, or could have been a ghost. It's just the way that it kind of haunts you in a very sort of heavy way, where, you know, you can have all the science in the world, but there's still that experience, that subjective experience, which you just can't pin down and just can't explain. But yeah, so in the 20th century, we get the development of sleep clinics. We discover REM. Nathaniel Kleitman is doing all this work in terms of looking at brain waves and figuring out what happens to our brain when we dream. And so I think to some extent sleep became very clinical, and we were trying to sort of explain away all the ghosts and things like that. But interestingly, what I noticed when I was doing all this research is that it seems to be that the cultural iconography of the era reflects the kinds of things that we have nightmares about. And so as you get towards the end of the 20th century into the 21st century, suddenly you get these anecdotes of people that think they have been abducted by aliens, but actually what they're describing is the exact same symptoms of sleep paralysis, in the same way that people were describing when they were accusing people of witchcraft in the 1690s, because there's a part of sleep paralysis where when it ends, you feel this really bizarre weightlessness. So you've been weighed down for ages, and then suddenly it feels like you've been lifted up. I had a really weird episode the other week where I really felt this feeling of weightlessness, and I thought I was stuck to the ceiling. I genuinely thought, how am I going to get down from the ceiling? And then I woke up and I was back in my bed. So that feeling of weightlessness seems to be what we're focusing on in terms of modern anecdotes, because it feels like, you know, you're being beamed up or beamed back down from an alien spaceship. So I think even though we have all this science now to explain sleep disorders, the cultural iconography of, you know, aliens and that kind of thing, which obviously wasn't present in the Victorian era, that seems to be what is sort of infiltrating people's sleep, and particularly sleep paralysis as well. You know, if you look at these anecdotes of alien abduction, you think, well, that could have been sleep paralysis, especially when it happens in the bedroom. You know, it really does feel like it could be sleep paralysis.
It's fascinating the sort of cultural history of that, of we move from witches to ghosts to aliens. It kind of makes you wonder what's going to be next. Do we think people are going to be uploaded into the Matrix, all that kind of stuff? Although I always point out to my friends that it's funny how all incidents of alien abduction and ghost appearances vanished with the introduction of mobile phones and cameras. Let's move on to the treatment, because you briefly touched on this earlier when you were talking about what we introduced in the 20th century. Treatment, people have always been looking to solve this problem. They've been trying to describe it. So how have treatment of night terrors evolved over time? Have they become less mystical and magical and more science-based? And what's the current treatment today?
Yeah, so I think when, to start with, early treatments of these disorders were aligned with those supernatural beliefs. So people thought that horses were being possessed by witches. And this is where we get the mare half of nightmare from. It comes from this idea of a possessed horse coming and trampling on you. And so people would hang things in stables, little rocks that had been eroded with to have a hole in the middle. They would hang those up. Also belemnites, which are fossilized squid bits. They call them thunderstones, and they thought that they somehow would protect you from witchcraft and having having the incubus and having sleep paralysis. So it was all to do with these sort of folkloric stones, really. People were using stones and minerals, and things like coral was believed to help with these sorts of attacks in sleep. And then we move into the feeling that sleep disorders were all to do with digestion. And so they would cure it in the good old fashion of purging and making you take laxatives and making you throw up everything that you'd eaten. And that was how you could have a really good night's sleep. And so, yeah, as we thought that sleep disorders were to do with poor digestion, the treatments were all to do with laxatives and emetics, things to purge you, essentially.
Alice, I've got a question. I don't know if this is a side question, but I maybe you can help. I was once do you know the story about how Kellogg's cornflakes were made?
I think I do.
You do. So I've heard a story that Kellogg's cornflakes were invented to help digestion, as you were saying, but also because the Mr. Kellogg wanted people to stop masturbating, and he believed that that Kellogg's cornflakes and giving them a good digestion and a good night's sleep would prevent them trying to play with themselves. Is that something you've come across? And it's a side note, but it's just kind of a weird one.
I've heard it, but that's not something I decided to explore in detail.
I'll have to dig into that a little bit more. Anyway, please continue.
Kellogg's, masturbation and dreams. I didn't think I'd hear those three words in a sentence.
Yeah, Alina is kind of stunned. I have come across it. I mean, I'm a science historian, so this is kind of my area of interest, and I have come across it, but I will delve a little bit further into this for future podcasts, and apologies for derailing your conversation. Anyway, so cures involving health and food, and trying to get a decent hearty food to make sure that you're actually getting through the night.
Yeah, and then as we kind of progress into the Victorian era, we get the sort of advent of pharmaceuticals and quack cures and things like that. And I found a particular cure called, I think, is it the blue pill? And if you took the blue pill, you would, it would help with sleep disorders, night terrors, hallucinations, sleepwalking, all that kind of thing. But the blue pill actually contained mercury, which causes hallucinations and delusions and all sorts of terrible things. So
Do not take mercury. I'm kind of fascinated by the imagery, because this ties into the Matrix, the red pill, the blue pill, and sort of that concept. So it's interesting how the language has moved on and is still with us.
Yeah, definitely. Some of the terms that we use today actually came from the Victorian era. So the Society for Psychical Research that I was talking about earlier, one of the key members, Frederick Myers, came up with the term hypnopompic hallucination, which is when we wake up, but our brain is still dreaming and we hallucinate spiders or people in our bedroom or that kind of thing. And he came up with that term, and it's still used in, medical science today, which I think is really fascinating. And I think he would be quite thrilled to know that, I think. Yeah.
So I find the next question really interesting because we're talking about night terrors and we're going to be talking about literature. I mean, explain to us how night terrors have impacted literature, for example, Dracula.
Yeah, well, that's quite a good segue, actually, because Bram Stoker, author of Dracula, was very good friends with Frederick Myers. And Dracula came out pretty much just after they published their results for this census of hallucinations. So the census went on for 5 years between 1889 and 1894. And Dracula came out a couple of years after that. And Bram Stoker used to have breakfast with Frederick Myers. And obviously, you know, knew about the society, probably knew about the census of hallucinations. And if you read Dracula from the perspective of thinking about sleep disorders, thinking about sleep paralysis, sleepwalking, night terrors, sleep talking, all those things, it kind of feels as though Dracula is just one big sleep disorder embodied in a vampire. So as Dracula begins, we see Lucy Westenra sleepwalking across the coast of Whitby. And then when Mina Harker starts to be attacked by Dracula, he seems to attack her sleep in particular. She's obsessed with her sleep in Dracula. She's always talking about her sleep. I think she says, "Tonight I shall strive hard to sleep naturally," which for me is an impossible task, but I like her optimism. And so he comes and when he attacks her, and there's that famous scene where you know, he's bitten her and she's drinking from him. There's a moment where she describes it as a leaden lethargy that's chaining her limbs, and it sounds like sleep paralysis. So the way that Dracula attacks people seems to be through troubled sleep, which I find absolutely fascinating. You know, if you read Dracula, there are so many instances of disordered sleep. And the fact that this came out just after the census, where so many of those anecdotes are about people having sleep paralysis or seeing things in their sleep, seeing weird things in their bedrooms, thinking that you know, their relative who lives on the other side of the world has visited them in their bedroom. I really do think that Bram Stoker possibly was influenced by the work of the Society for Psychical Research, and maybe even the census of hallucinations. So I think Dracula is a key text in terms of just how much of an influence these disorders can have in terms of literature.
And it's not just literature as well. I mean, there are other forms of art that have been very clearly influenced by night terrors. I mean, in your book, you write about Vasili's The Nightmare as an example. Was there a movement or a particular genre of depictions of night terror ever in art?
I don't think there's been a particular movement, but I think, you know, as I said before, I think every sort of era has its own iconography, and that is what is represented in art. So, you know, with Fuseli, it was the idea of the sort of demons and the supernatural and those kinds of things. Whereas today, we seem to be very fixated on the lucid dream, which is a kind of sleep disorder, essentially, but it's when you are dreaming and you realize that you're dreaming, and to some extent, you can control that dream. And so we get things like Christopher Nolan's Inception, but also there's a really good anime film called Paprika, which is pretty much where I think Inception got the idea from. But it does seem to be that it's not so much a movement, but it's a reflection of the sort of cultural ideas of what causes parasomnias, these sleep disorders.
Well, it's fantastic that it's been influencing art, and I always find it fascinating how much science has gone into just understanding something as simple as dreaming. And we still have these mysteries to this day. Nobel Prizes have gone into things like circadian rhythm in medicine and understanding how that works. We've looked at melatonin and how our bodies actually just try and function. But ultimately, we still have no real answers for many of the causes potentially of night terrors, and potentially the cures as well. There just seems to be something going on deep within us that's kind of fascinating and interesting. Alice, thank you so much for opening up our world and exploring some of the history of night terrors. The book sounds absolutely fantastic. Please can you tell people where they can get it and where they can find out more about your work?
So it's called Night Terrors, Troubled Sleep and the Stories We Tell About It. It's published by Icon Books, and you can find it in all good bookstores. And yes, I teach creative writing at Aberystwyth University. So you can always contact me via my university email address if you want to tell me about your weird dreams. I always like that.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.